In our league, I am paired up against Dark Angels doing Deathwing. So it's just a lot of Terminators and Deathwing Knights to chew through.
Do you know if he's brought in his Terminators as bloodied already?
No, we're not doing Crusade.
Oh, never mind then. Got it. Because in Crusade, one, you can spend a requisition point to have your Terminators coming in as bloodied. And one of the things you can have them have is a regen. Just to make them really not die. But the other thing about them is they're so slow.
They are. He was playing against Votan last week.
Oh, gosh.
And yeah, he said like they couldn't get into melee range of each other. So it was just...
Votan don't wanna.
No, Votan don't wanna, and Deathwing just has to walk. Welcome to Preferred Enemies, the Warhammer 40k podcast. That's the greatest good you're ever going to get. I'm your host, Rob.
Dennis, not Kevin.
And Richard.
And yes, we have no Kevin today. He is unavailable, but we are going to carry on because this episode has to come out today. Because today we are talking about the new Kroot Hunting Pack Army Box for the Tau Empire and the Tau Codex contained within. Kevin did give me his feelings on the new codex after revealing it. I'll tell you those later when we get to the meat of the book itself. But there's a little couple of local things I want to talk about. And then the other thing, and then we'll get into like part one will be the contents of the box and especially the new models. And then part two will be the codex itself. So before we get into Tau stuff, I did want to talk about the narrative league that I've joined. And then, Dennis, if you want to talk about the narrative league you are currently in.
Sure.
So I've been looking for a play group in the area, and I've been wanting to get into narrative play. And it's actually interesting how this happened because one of our local game stores, Pulp Fiction Comics and Games, which reopened last year after a few years, like they closed out like at the end of the pandemic, and then a new owner came in who was a previous customer of the store, came in, reopened it, and he's been working on building up community. And he had announced that, or he had advertised that they were doing Age of Sigmar weeks. And I'm like, well, I've been wanting to try out Age of Sigmar. I have a couple of Age of Sigmar armies that I need to justify the existence of, so I will go check that out. And the first week they were going to do it was I wasn't available, but then in February I went to show up, and it's like, okay, so are we, it was like, hey, are you still doing Age of Sigmar weeks? It's like, well, the Age of Sigmar group's kind of wrapped up for right now, but instead we have a 40k group that is just finished up a narrative campaign and they're getting ready to kick off a second one. I'm like, okay, that sounds great. So I go to check them out, meet them, all seem like a really good group of guys. And so I sign up to take part in their next phase of the narrative league. They are not doing Crusade rules. They are instead using the old like 8th edition Urban Conquest board, where it's like the city in like the big plastic folder with like all the card holders. So the city is developed randomly and there's like removable stickers to determine who has control of what. And so
that was the successor of the Planetary Conquest that I still have the tiles for, right?
Yeah, that was basically, well, it's like technically you could do, Planetary Empires and then move to this as like, okay, now you get into a hive city and now you actually fight at this level. So like you could do like a huge campaign with this if you wanted to, but we are focusing on this particular city. There is currently a relic that the Imperium holds in the city, and there are three other factions that are moving in to take it. We've got like all the Imperium players in one group, which is three players. We have 10 players in the league, three Imperium players. Then we have a pairing that is Eldar Votan. We have a pairing that is two Tau and then a Necron player, because it's like, well, we need to have the Xenos, we want the Xenos together in a faction, and we don't want the Necrons and the Eldari together, because that is just not going to work, because they are going to hate each other. So we put the Necron as like a surprise ally for the Tau, but if Tau ends up winning, they're going to do a grudge match against between the Tau versus the Necron, determine who actually is the winner. And then I am playing my Emperor's Children, and I am paired with a Chaos Knights player.
Oh.
And the Chaos Knights player is actually the one running the league, but because he is running the league, he did not want to be the leader of our faction. So I am the War Master of our faction. So woo-hoo. The Emperor's Children are plotting the course. And the rules for this are they are 1,000-point games, so they're done in like a couple hours. They are using chess clocks just to make sure everyone is getting done in a reasonable amount of time, and with like an hour per player. And the pairings are all set up the week before. So like games will be on Tuesday, and then like the following, like usually Thursday or Friday is when the pairings go up. So you have a few days to figure out who you're going to play against. And so you can, the idea is you know who you're going to be fighting. So you're going to try to tailor the forces you have to deal with them. Now, unfortunately, I was paired against Tau first week, and my player had a family emergency that came up that day. So I did not get a game, but they are tracking glory for everybody. And that determines like whichever group gets the most glory gets to basically choose their stuff first. And so if your opponent misses, you get max glory. So I effectively got max glory for the week, but I did get to watch the other games. It looks really fun. Like everyone seems to be having a good time. Our pairings for next. Well, when you hear this, I will have played this game, but going into this recording it, I will be playing against Dark Angels, specifically Deathwing Dark Angels this week. So I'm curious to see how that game's going to go, because we actually played a game together before the week before the league started, and I technically won on points, but he killed a lot of stuff because I just had trouble cracking his units. But I managed to outscore him by board control, which seems to be the rules for 10th edition these days.
Oh, yeah.
Board control wins games, not killing.
Yes, exactly.
So I've got a rematch with him, so I'll probably try to do a little bit of board control, but I also want to take the fight to him just because narratively it makes sense. I want a rematch. because he did kill my sorcerer in Terminator armor. So my sorcerer in Terminator armor wants to fight him again. It probably won't go well because Belial plus a unit of Deathwing Knights kills a lot of things, turns out, if you get close. Although, actually, technically, Belial did, and the Deathwing Knights did not kill the Sorcerer. The failed Dark Pax roll did.
Ouch.
He had, like, one wound left, rolled his Dark Pact roll, and only rolled, like, a 4. So it's like, oh, well, how many wounds, like... And then I took the mortal wounds and then proceeded to die. So Slaanesh was disappointed that I had lost that fight. Oh. It's been really fun so far, and everybody is encouraged to write a couple of paragraphs or so of lore describing their experience in our Discord group. So there's very much it is focused on telling a story. And I was talking with the guy running it, and he's basically like, I'm a D&D player at heart, and I got into 40K like a year or two ago. I tried getting involved in at a store where it's mostly competitive play, and it's like it was okay, but he ended up playing an opponent who was just hardcore, like, I'm going to manipulate the rules any way I can to win the game. And he's like, that is not the experience he wanted. So he found a group where he helped build a group where he could get that experience, and found a store that didn't have that hyper-competitive culture already baked in. And, of course, Pulp Fiction was looking at getting a group started up, so it all came together just about perfectly. So I found a group, and so far I'm pretty happy with it. So I'm looking forward to seeing this through. I think we are playing for 6 weeks total. So that will help me to my goal of at least one 40K game a month on average. So I'm also very happy that I missed January. Like, January sucked here between weather and getting sick. January just did not happen. But I got a game in February, at the end of February, and I'm going to get a game in. I'm going to get two or three games in March. So I'm feeling pretty good. How about your league, Dennis?
Well, interestingly enough, we're more focused on the crusade portion than the narrative. Because, yeah, this is a local group that we've got, and we're following it as much as we can. We have some differences. Like, one of the biggest differences was we're picking and choosing things from both books that are out, both the Tyrannic War and the Praia Nexus, mostly because there are some monster things, and we've determined we don't really like the Monster Hunter and Giant thing as much as just getting a upgrade that you can in Praia Nexus. But, yeah, we've got ours planned out. All the matches are planned out who you're going to play. We just don't have dates because we only play about once a month. And so we're going to try and speed it up by trying to get two games in on a Saturday as opposed to just one. That'll like speed up the time and double it. So we might actually get done before the end of the year. but yeah, we're in the first season still. All the other changes, we have six players. So we've divided up into our three factions. We've got a faction of Tyranid and Tyranid, a faction of Dark Angels and Space Marines. The player kind of has Space Wolf-ish models, but didn't take any of the things and said, I'm just using Gladius Detachment because Space Wolf's detachments are lame. Which, I mean, the Space Wolf Detachment is very much focused on narrative in a way because you got to get your leaders in there. But at the same time, they're also playing with the models they have. So that's a big thing I've noticed with this group is it's mostly playing with the models you have rather than someone like us, you or me, Rob, where we have an entire a plethora of things to go through to pick an army out of. And that does change up how you play.
Very much so.
The other difference there is, then the third faction is Eldar and Necron. So, yeah, they're getting along. See? So the other difference is in Crusade, you're supposed to just play people outside of your faction, but we just wanted to play everybody. So we had our first game play against our own faction, because that way, if you win, you get three, and the loser gets one. But if you draw, you both get two. And so your victory points are still four, no matter the outcome of the game, because you track victory points for the faction. So that seemed pretty fair. And also that way people could get their feet wet, learn the rules with someone who's going to be very kind and say, yeah, you're my faction. Let's just play this as a training game type thing. So, yeah, next time I will have to play against Eldar and Tyranids are going to be my two games in that day. And they're both the, I'll say, players who are more skilled than me already. So we'll see how those go. But no, it's been a lot of fun. And it's been fun building and growing a group. Unfortunately, the problem I'm running into is you'd think as big as Dallas is, they'd have a lot of stores, but there really aren't. And most of those stores will have tournaments. So I think we can find two, maybe three tables on a Saturday. But it's actually really hard to find gaming stores that have the space here. Because, I mean, there's lots of other events and there's so many people that like to play that we have more players in this area than we do actual tables. So I don't know that I'll actually try and grow this group any bigger because I think six is working out. And so, yeah, we'll get more games in and see how it goes. Yes, and I gave you my tips on the Deathwing Knight since I'm running one. And against Tyranids, I'm going to throw a second squad of Deathwing Terminators in there to go along with the Knights.
You know, it's funny you mentioned that the like your Space Wolf players like, well, the Space Wolf detachment is pretty bad. And, we just covered Dark Angels, and Dark Angels are doing okay competitively, but that's because they're not using the Dark Angel detachments. They're still using like the Iron Storm detachment from the Space Marine Codex. So it's just like it's Space Marines with just a tiny, and I think Azrael's the only character that's getting played.
Well, I'm actually
might
using
as well not be a Dark Angels army.
Well, I'm actually using him in my crusade list because, I mean, for one, he's the only character that can give me a CP around, which CP is a very much needed resource. So I want the character that can give me that. And also, unlike normal play where you can ditch a secondary for a command point, can't do that in crusade. So he's even more important to have. And then the other part of it is he gives his entire squad a 4+ invulnerable. And so that just helps make them live longer because people know that AP kills things. So having a 3+ armor, 4+ mm-hmm. invulnerable is very nice. And he's a chapter master, which means you can still attach a secondary leader to his unit. So I totally understand why he's around. I will say, though, for this narrative, I am running detachments out of the Dark Angels book, though. So,
and I think my opponent is going to be running the Deathwing detachment. So
that's what I'm running.
Yeah, I think it's comes down to competitive play is more where you're only going to see the one, like, you're going to see people leaning to the Space Marine detachments for the for the Divergent chapters, which again doesn't give me a lot of hope for my Blood Angels or your Space Wolves, but we'll see what happens.
Oh, they'll be fine.
Spoilers, I don't know if the Tau Codex gives me a lot of hope either, but we'll get to that when
it'll
we get
be
to that
fine.
So it'll most likely be fine. Let's actually talk about the Kroot Hunting Pack army box. So Games Workshop provided us with a copy of the army box and codex, and so thank you for that. And I will say, like, the presentation on this box, I know you said that the presentation on the Deathwing box, which I did not, like, when we got it, I immediately sent it to you. I did not open it up. I did not want to take, I wanted you to have that experience. So
And it was a phenomenal box, and it did feel like, wow, this is a real box opening. So I completely understand what you're going for with what you're going to describe on the Kroot opening, because this was probably 100% the same experience.
So with the Hunting Pack army set, so you open it up, there are all the sprues on top of, like, a divider. That's pretty standard. Lift up the divider, and inside there is a, like, blue metallic slipcase with the codex art on it. You open that up, and inside is the codex, which the collector's edition codex in here, again, blue, kind of a blue framing on the art. Cover is stamped with, like, a blue metallic Tau symbol and some, like, Tau sept style markings. The back cover features Kroot art with the same kind of blue metallic stamping, and even says Tau Va on the back in Tau font, which is just, it looks really nice. There's a second box inside that includes the data cards. Now, I don't have the original Tau data cards that GW released. I printed my own on, like, 4x6 photo cards. So unlike you, where you're like, oh, these cards are slightly smaller, I'm like, these cards are slightly larger. They're much easier to read. So I had the reverse experience than you did with the Deathwing, or from the Deathwing army box. The cards themselves are edged with the same blue metallic gilt that you see on the codex cover. So it's a really nice set of cards. It does include, it's like every data sheet plus the combat patrol data sheets plus the army rule plus a card just listing what all the drones do. So it's a very comprehensive set of cards. And I'm like, this is, if you're getting into Tau, if you're an existing Tau player, like, this is a really nice box just for the extras, just like for the codex and the cards. And then we get into the models, and I will say that the Kroot models look really good. I even compared them. I rebased a few of my older Kroot models from 25s to 28s to match what's in the new box. So be aware that Kroot are now on slightly larger bases. That seems to be a pretty standard thing we're seeing. Size-wise, they're very close to the older Kroot. I think the only difference is the older Kroot tend to have more hunched stalking poses, whereas I think these Kroot are more standing a little bit more upright. But, like, as far as I did a side-by-side on the Kroot rifles that each group is holding, they're the exact same size. So they haven't really upscaled the Kroot. If they did, only very slightly, but I think it's more poses than anything that makes the difference. So if you have old Kroot and you get these new Kroot carnivores, they'll blend in pretty seamlessly.
Just gotta rebase.
That said, the parts between them, other than maybe heads, because the heads are on sockets, which are pretty universal, the arms and torsos will not be compatible between the two, but the Kroot box They give you 20 Kroot models inside, and there are 22 possible variations. Like, each body makes one of two Kroot, and a couple of them make up to three. And they do list all of them. There's like two or three options for what they call a long quill, which would be their equivalent of sergeants. Not that it matters in the rules. There are no sergeants in the data sheets. But they do give you those options if you want to have like a couple of character style Kroot. One of the first ones they let you build has the tiny Kroot hound pup that you can put on the base, which is just adorable. There's a couple of different weapon options. I haven't dug into all of them. I've been really busy at work this week, which is like the timing couldn't be worse. But I did get a chance to build a few of them just so I could see them side by side and get a feel for how they go together. And honestly, like I'm really happy with the Kroot Carnivore models. I think it's a good replacement for the older Kroot box. So, and like I said, they'll go side by side. They're fine. The two new characters that they put in there, the War Shaper and the Flesh Shaper, are really good. The Flesh Shaper does not have any options. It's just built as is, but it still looks very nice. He's got a couple of like butcher blades that he's got, and he's definitely coming in and like a leaning forward, charging in to hack something up pose. The War Shaper does have a couple of options because you can either give him a bow and tri-blade, which I chose that because of the rules, because that weapon is anti-infantry 3-up assault heavy, as opposed to the full melee options, which are the blade stave and prey hook, which are just lethal hits. I mean, still lethal hits is good when you're talking about a unit that's only like strength 4, strength 5. So it's not bad if you want to get them to melee. I just went with the shooting option. But they give you the options for doing both, which look fine. They got a couple of variant heads you can use, so you can mix and match it a little bit. So characters so far look really good. Scale is right along. They're on 32 bases rather than 28, but that's not unusual for characters. They're about the same height as the Kroot Carnivore. I think the War Shaper looks a little taller, but he's standing on a slight bit of Hero Rock, so that's to be understood. There's one Krutox Rider in the box. The Krutox are interesting in how. First off, I'm very happy to finally own one because for the longest time they were metal and then they were fine cast, and I did not have either. So I finally have a Krutox. And, like, all put together, he's fine. The act of putting him together is a little bit weird in a couple of places just because there are certain things that are cut in half to be rejoined that didn't make a lot of sense to be cut in half. Like, his face is two halves to clap around a neck rather than just something that you socket onto the body. The arms are split into two halves, each arm, left and right side, to get put together. And I imagine it's just for ease of putting on the sprue. There's a couple of oddities in the build, but I will say the Krutox Rider, like the Krutox with the gun, and you get a couple of gun options, goes together pretty well. A couple of oddities in how it's modeled, but it still assembles very well. You may need to do a little bit of like green stuff or sprue goo at a couple of those joins, like on the face and such, if you don't get them lined up just right. But he's very stable because he's a gun platform, so his like front knuckles are on the base and his back feet are on the base, and I like him. I compared him with a crisis suit as far as scale because they're both on 50 millimeter bases and it's about the same size, so it's a good alternative to a crisis suit. Then there's the Krutox Rampagers. There are three of them in the box. I've only had time to put one together, and that was an experience. Again, the body is cut into several pieces. The torso is like four pieces, and the one that gave me the most trouble was that the front of the torso, there's a separate piece for the head and or for the neck and tongue. The tongue, because you can have it with open or closed mouth, and if you happen with open mouth, you want a tongue coming from inside. And that piece, the joints aren't as neat as some of the other, like there's some joints on some of these models where once you get them together, they're seamless. Not so much with this one. And also I was using cement rather than super glue. And that's a piece I think I would recommend using super glue for. And the reason is super glue sets much faster. If you're doing this with cement, you need to let that thing cure for at least a couple hours to before you attempt to do any more work on it. Because while I was working on mine, the bond gave way a bit and the neck piece started going inside the torso and I had to fish it back out, which was not fun. And with cement, because it actually melts the edges of the plastic, it also means that, like, you can kind of see now where that join went loose and then came back in. So I'm not terribly happy with that. Again, the face is two pieces, and the joins, I had to kind of put some extra cement over the joints, let that cure, and then shave it off this morning to smooth that out a bit. So just, again, those joins, you're going to want to watch for those lines, especially if you want to do this as, like, any level of, like, display level painting. The other thing that bothers me about the Krutox Rampagers, at least the first one, I have not checked the other two, but the first one, again, GW loves models that defy the laws of physics, or at least attempt to, because, so, this thing attaches to its base by a hero rock. Okay, fine, that's great. However, its other front legs are up in the air as it is charging at somebody. They are not touching the base. So your point of contact is that hero rock. The hero rock has the toes of that one leg that is touching the hero rock on it. Your join point is the toe joint between the foot and the toes, because the foot is on the leg that's on the torso. That one also tried to give on me at one point, so I had to basically set the model upside down and let it sit overnight to cure and be solid. So these are things you need to be aware of with these the Krutox Rampagers. I'm assuming the other two may have similar issues. If so, I will report them like on our next episode when I get them all put together. Editor's note, I worked on the other two Rampagers after recording, and I can confirm that allowing the cement to set before you start assembling the full torso and completing the model really does make a difference in how easily they go together. I had zero problems with Rampagers 2 and 3, so if you are using plastic cement, just take your time. Figure out which steps you want to break on, but definitely make sure that the neck and torso are fully cured before you proceed any further. The model, like, despite the issues I had with it, again, they look great. I think that this new Krut line looks fantastic. I can't wait to see the Lone Spear, the one that's riding the big lizard. I'm excited for that one, because that one also looks like it's going to be really good. So far, the new Krut line looks really good. Model, like I said, one or two of the models are a little frustrating to work with, but otherwise, I think it's a good box. And I will say, we'll get into this when we get into the Codex, a full Krut army is theoretically viable. Good? I don't know yet. But based on like the quality of the models and the variety they give you, I have put together a couple of possible like all Krut lists, and it seems like they would probably get some work done, especially if you're playing an area control game, which
you'll just have to use them against White Scars.
we will line them up across one side of the board and the White Scars will lose. That's just the rules. We don't make them. Yeah. That's just how it plays. Shout out if you know that old bit of 40K lore. Enjoy the chuckle. So that is what's in the box. There are no Tau mini, like prime Tau, like, you know, crisis suits or fire warriors or anything. Those are not in this box. Also, without getting too far into the Codex, I will say that much like with the Dark Angels, we got a new combat patrol for the Tau. I won't get into the rules for them quite yet, but as far as the new loadout, it is a commander, a devilfish, a unit of Pathfinders, and a unit of Breachers. So if you bought that and this, that would be a good way to get started. I don't know how much the army box is going to be, but I imagine it's going to be close to what the Deathwing one was. So I imagine this is probably going to come in at that 200 to 220 level. Combat patrols 160, so 380, not terrible for getting a start on this for this faction. I will say, if we go off the points in the book, because that's really not going to be accurate, but because I compared the points in the book to the points on the latest Munitorum release, which just came out, and they did update the Deathwing points with the new units. Anything that was new is pretty much what it was in the book. I think the only change is the Deathwing or the Ravenwing command squad is 130 points now. But everything else, like the Deathwing Knights are the Deathwing Knights are 235. They're what they were before. So they didn't get worse. Our concern was like a 290. They were worthless. They're not there. They're much closer to playable.
They're still expensive at 235.
They are still expensive at 230. So you get 465 points worth of, again, going off the points in the codex, 465 points worth in the army box. And 475 in the combat patrol. I think both of those are going to be closer to 400 each. So you're looking at about 800 points probably between the two boxes. So I do think, if nothing else, picking this up for the special edition codex and the cards and the new models is absolutely worth it. And they'll be good additions to any Tau army. If you are wanting to play Tau, I do recommend picking up this box. I think it's a good purchase. Now, whether you want to play Tau or not, we're going to talk about that in the in part two, which we will be getting to shortly. But first, if you want to talk to us in person, one thing you can do is join our Patreon and get access to our Discord. We are at patreon.com/preferredenemies. You can basically join that. It's $1 a month minimum. We don't have multiple levels. There's no paywall on episodes. This is just if you want to help support the show and join us on our Discord, where we're building up a community of people who are just having a great time talking about 40K, sharing things they're working on minis wise and things they are working on or games they've been playing. So it's a great place to hang out. And again, that's only $1 a month. If enough people put in $1 a month, it really does add up and help out. It pays for our hosting, it pays for our recording service, it pays for new microphones and occasionally travel costs. So we really do appreciate everybody who helps support the show, and that's why we have our Discord, so you can come hang out with us and talk about this hobby that we love so very, very much. So again, that's at patreon.com/preferredenemies. So we're going to go ahead and take a break for sponsor identification, and when we come back, we will be digging into the book, the Codex Tau Empire. See you in a bit.
Miniatures. We build them, we paint them, we love them. That's why we also want to get them to the battle and back again safely.
And that's where Kara Multicase comes in. They offer a complete model storage and transport system.
They offer a wide selection of core trays for standard size miniatures, as well as custom cut trays for specific models.
KR's trays are made of a soft foam, available in a variety of colors that won't scratch or snag your models.
And to protect the foam, the trays are carried in easily stackable, swappable cardboard cases.
They also offer a full range of Kaiser bags, backpacks, and aluminum cases for transporting your KR cases.
You can even choose from pre-built tray selections to suit your army, or use the autofill app to find just the right trays for your particular force.
Whatever your game, 40K, X-Wing, Worm Hordes, or Historicals, KR Multicase has the cases to fit your needs.
You can find out more at krmulticase.com.
KR Multicase, soft foam for your figures, hard cases for the soft foam.
Are you tired of playing on a boring battlefield? Do you want to step up the quality of your gaming table and make your battle look real?
Then you need to check out the battle mats from GameMat. Their professionally designed rubber-based mats are just what your gaming table needs.
Available in a variety of styles, with everything from rolling grasslands to urban war zones, winter wastelands to alien deserts, there's a GameMat mat to fit any kind of terrain.
Their mats are padded, anti-slip, waterproof, and when you're done rolling dice and battling on your mat, just roll it up and stick it in the convenient carrying bag for easy transport and storage.
And if you don't have a gaming table, they've got you covered with their folding G-board portable gaming area and their line of pre-painted resin terrain.
If you're ready to upgrade your gaming table, head over to www.gamemat.eu and find the gaming mat that's right for you.
Game Mat, giving your armies the battlefield they deserve.
And we're back, and that means it's time to dig into our other part of the review of this army box, which is the new Codex Tau Empire. If you are not familiar with the Tau, they are actually, I think they've been replaced. No, I'm going to say they haven't been, because they are the last new faction introduced to 40K. Now, when I say that, yes, we have had Gene Stealer Cults and Leagues of Votan, but Gene Stealer Cults existed in like second edition, and so did Squats. So I'm not going to say Leagues of Votan are new. They're an old faction brought new life, but they are not a new faction.
Harlequins are part of Eldar Codexes before, and Custodes have been mentioned since Rogue Trader.
Right. And Necrons actually existed in early third edition. Necrons actually predate the Tau references. Mechanicus was always mentioned, but never actually had rules. But the Tau were the last, like, brand new, never been seen before in 40K faction as of like 2003, I think, when they were introduced. So, like, they were introduced at the tail end of third edition, I believe. But they are basically a faction that leans very much into their high-tech war gear, similar to the way the Leagues of Votan do, but as where Leagues of Votan were effectively a offshoot of humanity that never gave up their technology and just altered themselves for the jobs that they were doing. The Tau are a completely alien race. They were actually first detected by the Imperium in around Millennium 35, when a Mechanicus Explorer fleet discovered this species on a planet, which we now know to be called Tau, by the peoples who live there. And when they discovered them, they had barely I don't even think they had discovered black powder yet. They were a very primitive species. And so the Mechanicus basically just kind of took a basic note, said, we'll mark this planet down for later cleansing and resettlement, meaning they were going to commit a genocide eventually when they got around to it and then set up Imperial colonies. But a warp storm came into the general vicinity of Tau and blocked off travel to and from that space. And so the Imperium just kind of forgot about them and never got around to it. In the intervening time, a few things happened to the Tau. Originally, the Tau had split up into four different warring camps. The air caste, which lived up in the mountains, the water caste, which lived near the rains and or lived near the rivers and lakes, the earth caste, which basically lived kind of at the roots of the mountains and in the hills, and then the fire caste, which lived in like the plains and veldt of this planet. And these four groups fought constantly, and they had all adapted to their particular environments and also had managed different skills. Like the air caste were better at, like, they had managed to like develop crude hang gliders and things like that, so they were used to, they learned how to basically fly. The earth caste were sturdier and could were good at creating things and building things. The water caste were good at diplomacy, and the fire caste were very good at hunting. But these four groups fought, and in fact, during their wars, a plague came and started decimating their species. Like, it was not a good time for the primitive Tau. And then one night, some lights appeared above one of one of the mountains in the area, and a new envoy from a fifth, hitherto unknown caste known as the Ethereals came to representatives of, they visited all four of these tribes and said, you need to send your leaders up to the mountain with us, and we're going to have a sit down, and we're going to talk about how you are all destroying yourselves, and we're going to save you. And so the leaders went up there, and then when they came back down, they're like, the ethereals have shown us the proper way we should all be working together for the good of our entire species. We should be putting aside our differences and combining our strengths for the greater good, which is also in the Tao language called the Tao Va. And
so, the greater good.
The greater good. If you've seen Hot Fuzz, you'll get that reference. And the culture changed practically overnight. And with the no longer having to focus on fighting each other, their development, their technological development skyrocketed. And so in the early parts of the 40th millennium, you know, like somebody found the old records of the from the Mechanicus Explorer fleets and said, oh, hey, the warp storms have cleared away. And there's this planetary system that we were going to go cleanse and repopulate. I wonder how that's gone. And so they showed up, and suddenly there is a technologically advanced species whose technology in most ways outpaces the Imperium by a great deal, and that has expanded to other nearby star systems and have created their own empire. And that is the Tau Empire. The Tau have gone through several what they call spheres of expansion, where they've expanded further and further out. And unlike the Imperium, they don't hate automatically every alien species they come across. They attempt to bring them into the fold because they're like, your strength and your skills could benefit us, and our technology and our skills could benefit you. We could have a mutually agreeable coexistence under the Tau Va, and sometimes that works. There's a number of what they call auxiliary races in the Tau Empire that have their, you know, that have become part of, you know, that have become part of this Tau Union. And it's actually very interesting to see how different it is. It's not perfect. There's still rumors of, like, the Tau occasionally, you know, sending, like, they've even done this with humans. There are human planets that have decided, you know what, the Imperium doesn't care about us. The Tau seem to be actually offering us things that we can use. So they'll actually join and become human auxiliaries. But there's also been stories about some human auxiliaries being sent to re-education camps and occasionally being sterilized. So don't think that these are necessarily the good guys of the, of the 40K universe.
The greater good.
There aren't any. But, like, they mention in one of the sidebars, they do mention some of the other races. Like, there's the Kroot. The Kroot were one of the first ones they brought into the fold. And the Kroot could not be more different than the Tau. The Kroot are very tribal. What, by first appearances, they'd be technologically less advanced than the Tau, and they do occasionally use some Tau technology that they're given. Although, unlike the Tau, they have ships that can actually traverse the warp. There's other races, the Vespid, the Nikasar, the Nikasar are actually a psychic race, the Anthrozods, which we've never seen before, might work on mining asteroids, the Nagi, are these like small worm-like creatures, the Fosiab, who can see the universe in nine dimensions, and they mention humans as well. So, like, there's a number of species that have just been brought into the fold because, like, hey, we can help each other out. They've also tried with some other species, like orcs. Hasn't gone well. For some reason, orcs are not open to diplomacy.
Oh, sure they are. It's with teeth and guns.
Yeah, no. I mean, they want to fight, so...
Yeah.
That's what they're made to do.
And so, in cases when diplomacy fails, that's when the Firecast gets brought out, and that's when the Tau bring the technology that the Earthcast has been developing to bear. So the Tau actually have a couple of specific fighting styles that they use. One is called Mokka, and one is called Kaoyan. Mokka means killing blow. And basically, that is pick a target, overwhelming force, destroy it. The other is Kaoyan, which stands for patient hunter. And That is the, we set traps, we lure the enemy in, and then once they are caught in the trap, pincher them off and destroy them. So they're bringing, again, I said the Firecast were hunters, and they have brought that hunting style into their fighting techniques and fighting philosophies. The Tau don't generally believe in doggedly holding on to territory. They will leave territory because that's a good way to draw someone forward into one of those traps. What's more important is keeping, like, having Tau survive and eliminating the enemy. Territory is a thing you take when the enemy is dead. So, like, the Tau are a very, like, they are a good set of fighters. Now, physically, they are not great. They are really not trained for close combat. They are, the average Tau is about the same as the average human, and they find close combat to be rather barbaric, which also why they don't have a very high opinion of orcs. However, they have some of the best guns in the universe. I'd say the Necrons and the Votan give them a run for their money, but otherwise they're way up there technologically. They're particularly known for their rail guns, which are absolutely devastating to armor. The Ethereals are still in charge. There's rumors that the Ethereals may have been genetically altered. In fact, there's an old book, I don't even know if it's considered canonical now, called Xenobiology, or it may just be Xenology, but actually had somebody doing a dissection of a captured Tau Ethereal, and it's like, well, they've got this little organ in their head that gives off pheromones, and Tau can't help, but if they smell the pheromones, they just can't help but follow whatever the Ethereal says. And so it's possible the entire species was brainwashed. It's also possible that someone created the Ethereals, that because they, it wasn't like there was this fifth tribe that was somewhere else in the world that nobody had just met yet. They came from space, apparently. We are, you know, lights in the sky. So there's a couple of mysteries. They've never been answered. However, there is one group of Tau that do not follow the Ethereals, and that's because there's a commander named Commander Farsight, who has a fantastic model, one of the newer models that they re-released of him last year. And Farsight was on an expedition to fight orcs. There was an orc incursion into Tau space. They were going to follow the orcs to the source and take them out. And during the expedition, all their Ethereals got killed. And the Tau Empire lost contact with Farsight. And Farsight noticed that with the Ethereals dead, it wasn't like Tau's, their forces didn't collapse. They're just like, well, we're here. We still have to fight. And they fought. They succeeded. And they're like, wait a minute. We don't need the Ethereals to tell us what to do. So we don't need to go back to Tau space. They're just going to tell us that, you know, they'll just take control of us again. So how about we just do our own thing and set up our own society here, our own set of colonies? And so when the Tau made contact again, finally, with the Farsight enclaves, they were like, wait, what? You're not with Ethereals, and yet you haven't all the horses haven't started eating each other? So the Tau are not pleased. Farsight is considered a criminal among Tau, but he's got some very loyal, like, that the Farsight enclaves loyally support him. He's also ancient, far older than any Tau should be, and that's because during the whole situation where all the Ethereals got killed, he found a relic called the Dawnblade. And what it turns out, and he isn't even aware of this, is that when someone is killed with the Dawnblade, what is left of their lifespan gets added to his. So he's killed a lot of things. He's effectively immortal as far as old age goes. Nobody knows how long he'll actually live. And it's even suggested in one of the older books that if he ever found out why he's living so long, he'd probably kill himself because he would not find it to be an appropriate way to live longer. But he doesn't know that that's why he's alive so long. So you have the Farsight enclaves, and apparently other Tau have been smuggling them new technology because the Tau are very disturbed that his forces keep getting stuff that's been developed since they left. So there are secret Farsight enclave supporters inside the rest of the Tau Empire. So you've got some nice little conflict there. I honestly find the fluff for the Tau to be fascinating. And the codex, this codex actually does a good job of showing off a lot of the different technology. Like, they show off all the different styles of battle suits that they've developed, because this is the Gundam faction. If you like giant robots that aren't Imperial Knights, this is the faction for you. They show off like all the different war gear systems and like what like each bit actually references. These don't matter because most of them don't actually matter for rules, but they used to. They show all the different marks of drone and what they can do. They even show you like how the different color schemes on helmets go. Like, it's actually nice seeing some heraldry samples. And so, yeah, the fluff on this is really nice. I really like the Tau fluff section. I like the rules, and I like the descriptions. I like the photo section, even though it's mostly the white Tau armor that they use now rather than the old tan. And I've actually been in a room with Chris Peach and talked with him, and back at like LVO, and they switched to the white because it photographs better. But it, you know, it's a good photo section. And then we're going to get into the rules of the Tau Codex. And if you are familiar with the Tau Index, their army rule has not changed. Their army rule is also probably one of the clunkiest and most complex. I know, Dennis, you still don't like how it's worded.
No, I mean, I get it. There's got to be a different way of doing it.
Yeah, so the army rule here, and when I say it's complex, when 10th edition first dropped, even Tau players were not sure how this worked. They found it very complex. So basically, the rule is called For the Greater Good, and it says, when a unit is selected to shoot, you can choose another unit to act as an observer for it. The observer unit picks the target that the unit... So, again, trying to word... I'm going to word this the way... I'm going to just use the text from the book. And I will say, they did provide a nice diagram to actually explain how this works.
Diagrams help. I was already falling asleep to your stereo instructions.
I know. So, every time you select a unit to shoot, if it's not an observer unit, you can use this ability. If it does, you select another friendly unit that is also eligible to shoot, not counting fortification, battle shocked, and observer units. Until the end of the phase, the unit that is shooting is considered a guided unit, and the friendly unit is considered an observer unit. Then select one enemy unit that is visible to both units to be the spotted unit. So, spotted unit is target, guided unit is shooter, observer unit is the one pointing at the spotted target. Until the end of the shooting phase, whenever the guided unit shoots at the spotted unit, they add one to their ballistic skill characteristic, not the roll, to the ballistic skill characteristic itself. So you can still attach bonuses, like heavy will still apply if you are... if you are guided, because that's a bonus to the hit roll, not to the ballistic skill. If the observer unit has the marker light keyword, the attack also has ignores cover. Now, the downside is every time a model in a guided unit makes an attack that doesn't target the spotted unit, you lower their ballistic skill by one. So, for example, the average fire warrior, which would be your strike teams and your breacher teams, has ballistic skill on their shots of 4. If they are guided, that becomes a 3. If they decide to shoot at another target, those shots are hitting on 5s. So if you shoot at the good target, your shots are better. If you shoot at anything else, it gets worse. And there will be units that have rules that interact with, like, hey, if this is a observer, then the guided unit gets to do this. Like, if this unit did the spotting, the unit they're guiding gets to, like, re-roll certain things. The downside on this is it really punishes you if you have a vehicle or a unit that either needs to split fire or has multiple guns that are good at different things. Especially there's a couple of larger ones like the Storm Surge, which has like a gun that's really good against killing vehicles and then a lot of guns that are really good at killing infantry. And if you ever guide it, whatever target you didn't like, the guns that aren't good for the target you picked are going to be either relatively ineffective against that target anyway, or they're going to be less effective against the things that they can actually hurt or that they are made to kill, which that is very frustrating. I really wish they had gotten rid of the lowering their ballistic skill and just let it be a bonus. Like, that would have been so much better. But they didn't. They kept it the same. So this isn't any better or worse than what was in the index. It's the same as the index. It's just this was an opportunity to improve it, and they didn't. But, they're happy with how it works. It's fine. And again, at least they provided a diagram which has the Tau fighting orcs, which is as it should be. I do appreciate them providing a visual aid.
Yes.
There's also the rules for drones. In older editions, drones were little extra units that you got to add to your, like, a lot of your units can take like up to two drones, and all the drones provided special abilities, and they were notorious because like shield drones could just tank shots forever because they'd have a 4+ invulnerable save, and you could run whole units of drones and just like have them defend the nearest units, and people hated that in older editions. I mean, I think before recording, Dennis, you were talking about how unfun that was to play against.
Yep.
So in this edition, with 10th edition, they completely changed how drones worked. And again, this is the same as in the index, where the drones are basically just extra abilities you can give to units. You can use the drone models to use as tokens to indicate like, hey, this is the unit that has a pair of gun drones, or this is the unit that has a shield drone and a missile drone or something like that. Different units can take different kinds of drones. And again, they're just abilities. You don't even technically need to have the drone models on the table. They don't count as models for any purpose. They don't have OC. They don't have stat lines. They are just there to represent war gear.
Yeah, that's not surprising, because that's how they've moved. Like, a lot of the orc units would have like little Gretchen models mm-hmm. that went along with them, and that's just how all of those, like Grot Oilers and Grot Medics and stuff like that, have just been moved to, okay, this is a token for most of them were actually like once per game abilities, and like you just remove the Grot once you've used the ability, and that's the reminder that you've used the ability.
Right. And honestly, considering how 10th edition keeps track of like starting strength and half strength and objective control and things like that, it's probably the best way to handle it in this edition. Yeah. So I think it's absolutely fine. I don't have any issues with the drone rules. I think that it's a little sad that they don't matter as much model wise, but it also actually makes things a little bit cleaner on the tabletop. So again, as long as you're clear about what units, like, what you're using, and if you don't want to have like the models, like I'm sure there are people that make little acrylic tokens or things like that, which would just say like what drones you have for a unit, that's also fine. So again, I don't have any issues with the drone rules. Some units have drones that are specific to just them, like Pathfinders, or I think Pathfinders are the main ones. Ghost Keels also technically have stealth drones that they have as well. So yeah, it's just, you know, just keep track, use those to keep track of things when they're appropriate. But otherwise, yeah, it's very easy to just know like, hey, this unit has extra shots or a marker light or has extra wounds because they have shield drones, stuff like that. Then we get into the detachments. There are four detachments here. And that kind of disappoints me just because other factions get so many more options. I mean, the last one we did was Dark Angels. They only had three, but they also had access to like all seven of the existing Space Marine detachments. So, in fact, most people are playing Dark Angels with one of the other Space Marine detachments. So they actually have a lot of options. Most of the other factions we've seen, like Tyranids had 6, Necrons and Mechanicus both had 5, Tau have 4.
Now, I will agree with you, Rob, that it feels like a disappointment that they have so few, because is this going to be something going forward where most factions only get 3 or 4? Because that just would feel sad, because I want to see 5 or 6 different detachments per codex, truthfully.
Yeah, I agree that's disappointing that they only have 4. I don't know. I just wonder if it has to do more with just the fact that Tau don't have melee.
Well, and that may be part of it, although one of the 4 detachments in here does kind of address that somewhat, because it leans into the one melee-focused section of the codex they have, which is the Kroot, which have been greatly expanded in this. We obviously have, this is from the new Kroot Hunting Pack army box, and this is only, like, what's in the army, what's in the hunting pack is only half of the new Kroot models that are going to be released. So there's even more options for them in that are coming out. So it's like I said, you can make a viable Kroot army in this with this codex. So, but you'd think that they would still have a couple more options, but we get 4, which is, and one of them is the one from the index. So with a couple of slight changes on strats and enhancements, but it is effectively the same. So that one detachment that we got from the index was the Kalyon, the Patient Hunter detachment. And that one functions the same as it did, where starting on battle round 3, your weapons gain sustained hits 1. Your ranged weapons have sustained hits 1. Sustained hits 2 if they are targeting a spotted unit. So, or specifically their spotted unit. So you don't have any ability turns 1 and 2. Turns 3, 4, and 5, you get sustained hits 1 at least, which is not horrible, but it does mean for the first 2 rounds of the game, you are having to basically get into position. Very thematic, but we had Kalyon as a fighting philosophy in 9th edition, and it was one of the least popular because it meant for the first third of the game, you didn't have a faction, you didn't have an ability. Now, in 9th edition, you did at least have like sept abilities and a lot more stratagems. In this edition, this is what you get, is this ability. Now, I do kind of like what they're doing with this, with a couple of the changes, though, because they're basically making Kalyon the area control detachment. Now, like, the enhancements kind of lean into the abilities, where there's one called Exemplar of the Kalyon, which lets the user start using Patient Hunter, like that sustained hits ability, on turn 2. That's a must have for a character.
Yeah.
They have Precision of the Patient Hunter, which adds 1 to all your hit rolls for the bearer, and starting on turn 3, you add 1 to the wound roll. So, hey, great for clearing people out, rounds 3 onward. The other old one was Through Unity Devastation, which basically, if the bearer's leading a unit, and whenever they are an observer, their guided unit gets lethal hits against the spotted target. This one was probably the one that was taken the least. It's a bit clunky. But the new one they added, and I say new because they took one of them away and moved it to another detachment. We'll get to that. But they put in one called Solid Image Projection Unit, which lets you redeploy 3 units after both armies are set up. After both armies deployed, you can redeploy 3, and you can put 3 of those into strategic reserves, even if you've already maxed out your strategic reserves. So, having stuff that's only going to come in maybe on turn 2 or 3 kind of plays into the, I'm setting things up, waiting for you to come into the trap, and then boom, I'll spring the trap. So that's a decent, and that's actually a very good enhancement for this particular detachment. The other things is there's a couple of new stratagems, one of which is called a tempting trap. During your shooting phase, you can't use this stratagem on turns one or two, but on turns three onward, you select a unit in your army that hasn't shot yet, and you select an objective marker that's not in your opponent's deployment zone. That becomes a trap objective marker, and anytime that unit is shooting at someone near that objective, you add one to the wound roll. That's actually pretty nice, but again, you can't do it on turns one and two. But it is leaning towards having objective control. And the other one they added was Wall of Mirrors, which at the end of your opponent's fight phase, you select a stealth suit, a ghost skill suit, or Commander Shadow Sun, and you move them off the battlefield and put them into strategic reserves. But you can't do anybody that's in engagement range. So you pick your stealthy units and pull them off the table. Now, the downside is none of your stealthy units can deep strike in, so they're going to be walking back in off of a table edge. But it does let you, like, later in the game, pull somebody out and reposition them to maybe take an objective from, you know, that's in an opponent's deployment zone. Otherwise, the strats are pretty much the same as they were before. There's one for getting back into a transport if somebody charges you. There's one that lets a observer unit get the same benefits as the guided unit, but without any of the penalties. So if you have one of those units that has like a bunch of guns on it, like a Storm Surge, have the Storm Surge be the observer, because then you can spend a CP and let it have the benefits of shooting at that thing without penalizing where it shoots at anything else. And then they have one called Point Blank Ambush, which if you're shooting at a target within 9 inches, you increase the AP of an attack by one. This detachment is fine, not great, not terrible. It's what Tau players have been using up until now, so everyone's going to be very familiar with it. I think it'll do fine. It lends to a very particular play style, which, again, that's what Tau players have been doing up until this time. Now, the next detachment is Mont-Ka, which is that killing blow. That's their detachment rule, and that says first three rounds of the game, your weapons have lethal hits, and if it's a guided unit, they have assault as well. So this one wants you to get right up there, get up close, move quickly, and shoot things. This was always the very popular one, the popular philosophy to use in 9th edition, because you had an ability the first three rounds of the game. They do have an exemplar of the Mont-Ka enhancement that lets it carry over into the fourth round. Again, if you were taking this, that is a must take. There's a Strike Swiftly enhancement, which you select up to two before scout moves are made. You select two Tau units within 6 inches of the bearer that don't have scouts. They gain scout 6 inch, which is really nice. Strategic Conqueror. This one I really like, because you don't have to even, you could have this like on an ethereal or somebody else sitting like way back on the board and not getting involved with anything. At the start of the first battle round, before the first turn begins, you select any objective marker on the battlefield. When a friendly Tau Empire model is within range of that objective and the bearer is on the battlefield, they don't have to be leading that unit. They don't have to be within so many inches of that unit. They just have to exist on the battlefield. That model, that units or the models in that unit, their OC goes up by one, which can make a huge difference in taking an objective.
Yeah.
That one's one of my favorites. And then Coordinated Exploitation. While the bear is leading a unit, each time that unit is an observer, then the guided unit gains sustained hits. So it's like they gain the Patient Hunter ability while they're guiding. So it's weird to want your primary, like your one of your characters, to be the observer. But at the same time, observers don't have any penalties and they can still shoot. They just can't be guided again because they were observers. And then their strats, I think, are really nice. Almost like a couple of them key off of infantry, which especially like combat debarkation, which is one of my favorites from the previous edition. You select a Tau infantry unit that got out of a transport, which is always going to be breachers. There's no other unit that you want to put in a transport. Until the end of the phase, whenever they attack the closest target, they can reroll the wound rolls. So good. Pulse Onslaught. This one's also really nice. Whenever one of your infantry units hits a non-monster, non-vehicle unit, that unit, this one costs 2 CP, but that unit is counted as shaken. They subtract 2 from their move and 2 from their advance and charge rolls, which can really slow down somebody's tactics. We've seen that on other weapons, like I think like the Earthshaker cannon for guards, stuff like that, have similar abilities. I think some of the Eldari like spinneret weapons have effects like that, like the Night Spinner has an effect like that. So yeah, anything that can like screw with somebody's movement is very good. Pinpoint counteroffensive. One of your Tau units was just destroyed. Every time another Tau Empire unit that's not Kroot targets the unit that killed your unit, you get to reroll hits. So, like, if you want something dead, that's a really good way to do it. Aggressive mobility. You auto-advance 6 inches. And then focused fire. Select 2 Tau Empire units and a target. And every time those 2 units shoot at that one unit, they improve their AP by 1, but they can't shoot it only at anybody else. But you can't use it to rounds 4 and 5. I think Moncaz is better than Kalyan, just because it does let you get that kind of alpha strike and has some interesting objective control elements with that strategic conqueror. I think in this, like, you would take Exemplar of the Moncaz and strategic conqueror every single time. Like, those are the 2 must-takes for this detachment, because they play into what you need to do to win games, and it just gives you the jump, but also Exemplar gives you a little bit more staying power if you need it near late game. Our third detachment is Retaliation Cadre. This one is the all battle suits all the time. We'll get into why that when we get to data sheets. We'll get into why that may not be the best thing, but, and they even mentioned the 8 Farsight and his band of other commanders, as like the perfect example of a retaliation cadre. This is all battle suits. Every time their rule is bonded heroes. Each time a Tau battle suit model from your army makes a range attack that targets a unit within 12 inches, which, you know, again, for a non-melee army, they really want you to get in close. Between Moncaz and this, they want you to be right there next to the action. Anytime you target an enemy unit within 12 inches with a range attack, the strength goes up by 1. If they're within 6 inches, the AP goes up by 1. That's not terrible. Like, an extra strength and extra AP is not bad. They actually got one of the enhancements and the 2 stratagems that were pulled away from the Kalyan and were placed here, because they got the Purgatide Engram chip, which allows you to target a unit twice with or lets you use a stratagem twice in a phase. Also, all these add-ons can only be on Tau battle suits. Starflyer ignition system. Basically, at the end of your opponent's turn, if you're not on in engagement range, you can go back into strategic reserves, and your crisis suits can all deep strike. So that's where that one's going to come into play. Internal grenade racks lets you move over an enemy unit and do mortal wounds to them on a 4-up. And then prototype weapon system lets you add either lethal hits or sustained hits 1 every time you shoot. So those are all nice for battle suits. And there's 2 battle suit characters, so they want you to take 2 to 4 commanders. However, your options for battle suit commanders also shrink. You've got failsafe detonator for 2 CP. This one's kind of interesting, because we've had like you automatically explode, you know, stratagems in past editions. This is the first one where I've seen where you can either definitely explode or definitely not explode. because when a unit is destroyed, you can target it. If they already had Deadly Demise, you can basically treat the roll as either a 6 or a 1. So it's like, it would be really bad if this guy explodes because I have a bunch of other units around. You can say he does not explode. If I have a bunch of enemy units around, I can say he automatically explodes. But if they don't have Deadly Demise, you roll a d6 for every unit within 6 inches of it, and on a 4 up, they suffer d3 mortal wounds. So you effectively create a... You can give a unit that doesn't have Deadly Demise a slightly better version of Deadly Demise, which I think is kind of interesting.
That, yeah, that's actually pretty neat. That seems super flexible.
It's very flexible. It does cost 2 CP, but I do like that it does have the option of, I don't want to blow up. I absolutely don't. I don't want to even risk it. I like that that's an option. Like, it's a very multi-use strat. I like that one.
I like the option of the someone who doesn't have it can set it off, because that means everyone's a bomb.
Nah, it's really handy. I mean, we've had something like Failsafe Detonator was a piece of war gear in the past, and it was a thing you could do, or it was a strat that you could basically cause mortal wounds whenever a battle suit was destroyed. But I like this is the best version of it I've seen. I really like this one. Next up, we've got Stim Injectors, which gives a battle suit Feel No Pain 6 up for a phase. Feel No Pain 6 up isn't great. It'll not save you a lot of the time, but it may make a difference once in a while. Shortened Blade lets you deep strike 3 inches away, but you can't charge, which isn't a problem for Tau. We don't care. But considering the abilities, getting the +1 strength and +1 AP if you're within 6 inches, that actually makes a big difference. So being able to deep strike that close is not a bad thing. Aerocon Protocol, this lets you try to kill units that have lots of models. You select a Tau Empire battlesuit unit that hasn't shot yet. If they target a unit that has 6 or more models, they have sustained hits 1. If it has 11 or more models, it has sustained hits 2. Not bad. Very conditional, but not bad. There's Torchstar Gambit, which used to be called Strike and Fade when it was in the Kalyan detachment in the index. This gives you jump, shoot, jump. Basically, you can take a normal move after you shoot. You just can't charge. Fine, I'm not going to charge, generally. So this is a classic Tau strategy. People hate jump, shoot, jump, or specifically hate playing against jump, shoot, jump. Congratulations, we still have jump, shoot, jump. And then finally, grab Inhibitor Field. When somebody charges you, they immediately take a battle shock test, and the Tau player rolls a d6 for each enemy model in the unit. For each 6 you roll, they take a mortal wound. In the past, grab Inhibitor Field usually just like reduced the charge roll by 2 inches. This is way nastier. Like, you still might get there, but you might be battle shocked, and you're probably going to lose a couple of models. I like the idea of the Retaliation Cadre. When we get into data sheets, I'll talk about why I don't actually like the Retaliation Cadre. Like, there's a few units that can work with it, but yeah. And then finally, we get the Kroot Hunting Pack, a.k.a. look, we have a melee option now. Every time a Kroot model from your army makes an attack, add 1 to the hit roll if the target of the attack is below starting strength. Add 1 to the wound roll if the target is below half strength. They are the anti-sisters, because they give the same benefit. They have benefits against what makes sisters stronger. Also, more importantly, Kroot models in your army have a 6 up and vulnerable save against melee attacks and a 5 up and vulnerable against ranged attacks. That's huge for them, because their armor saves suck.
Yep, that's good.
Yeah, now that right there is the difference between this being a viable option and not. Having a 5-up invuln on everything in range so you can actually get to close combat is huge. All the everything in here targets Kroot only. You can still... Now, this is not a Kroot-only detachment. It doesn't say you cannot use non-Kroot models, which I do appreciate, because they even mention... Like, sometimes they'll have Firecast handlers helping them, or Firecast bodyguards helping them. So you can still bring in your other Tau stuff. It's just you want to lean into Kroot. You can go all Kroot, but if you feel like, yeah, I'm going to go all into Kroot, except I need a hammerhead to deal with like heavy armor, you can still do that. However, your Kroot carnivores are also battle line, which is really nice. You can take up to 6 units of them, and Kroot carnivore have they have an ability that actually may make it you want to take more than 3 units of them. Their enhancements, again, are Kroot only. 3 of them are locked to particular types of shapers, because there are now 3 classes of shapers. So there's the Kroot Hot Flock, which is for any Kroot character. Ranged weapons equipped by the models in the bear's unit have ignores cover, and enemy units can't set up within 12 inches of them as reinforcements. So no deep strike within 12, no coming in from a table edge within 12. That's actually really good. Any sort of deep strike disruption is great. And then the three shaper-specific ones, trail shapers can take Nomadic Hunter. You add 3 inches to their move characteristic to any models when they're leading a unit, and all their ranged weapons have assault, so that makes them super fast. Root carved weapons for war shapers. All weapons equipped by the bear have precision and devastating wounds. That is terrifying considering some of the things that you can put on a war shaper. I think every war shaper should take that. And then Borthrod gland for flesh shapers. When the bear's leading unit, every time that unit makes a melee attack, unmodified hits of 5 up are considered criticals. Then there's strats. Join the Hunt lets you target a Kroot Infantry or Kroot Hounds phase that was just destroyed. You add that unit back into strategic reserves. You just had endless waves of Kroot. It does cost 2 CP, so it's expensive, and it cannot return destroyed characters. But still, like Kroot Hounds or Kroot Carnivores, being able to bring back a unit from them and have them come off the side, that's fantastic. Trap well laid. During your shooting phase or fight phase, you select a Kroot unit from your army that hasn't shot or fought yet. And after they've resolved their attacks, you select an enemy unit that was hit by one of them. Until the end of the phase, every time a Kroot model from your army makes an attack that attacks that enemy unit, unless the Kroot unit is battle shocked, you improve the AP by 1, which is good because a lot of their AP is kind of meh. But again, all you have to do is hit them to do this. So this one's actually pretty nice. EMP grenades, you select a Kroot grenade unit, which is generally going to be your carnivores, although I think a couple other units have the keyword. You select a unit within 8 inches of an enemy vehicle unit, and that enemy vehicle lowers its weapon and ballistic skills by 1 until the end of the phase. Grizzly Feast, after you have a Kroot unit from your army has defeated 1 or more enemy units in the fight phase, in your opponent's next command phase, every enemy unit within 6 inches of yours has to take a battle shock test. If they're below half strength, they subtract 1 from the test, and enemy units affected by the stratagem do not need to take any other battle shock tests in the same phase. So you can't like keep forcing them to do it. But the idea is that when Kroot kills someone, they tend to eat them, and it's so horrifying that every enemy unit nearby just has to go, oh god, I can't even. Guerrilla Warriors, you can fall back and still shoot and charge. And then Hidden Hunters, when your opponent has selected a Kroot unit to shoot at, they can only be selected as a target if the attacking model is within 12 inches, but it's after they've selected targets. Now, I want to say there's an FAQ that says they can reselect targets. I don't think it's a wasted shot, but still basically saying, no, this guy, you're too far away. You cannot target them. Basically give any unit lone operative. I'm good with that.
Yeah.
So the hunting pack is a pretty solid detachment. Like if you're leading into Kroot, it's just good. It's a neat army build. And so now, the part I have been looking forward to the least, the data sheets. First, let's pour one out for some of the units that are no longer with us. Anshi. Anva. Now, Anva I'm kind of fine with because canonically he's dead and has been replaced with a holographic recreation running on AI. I hate AI, so I'm fine with it being dead. Anva's gone. Long Strike is gone. Why is Long Strike gone? Because he was a fine cast upgrade to a Hammerhead. He's not around anymore. Tactical drones are gone. You can't take units of drones anymore. They only exist as add-ons for other units. Okay, that's fine. Considering that, like, shield drones didn't work the same way, and drones were just not being... It prevents you from having, well, these drones are just war gear, but these drones are an actual unit. Gets rid of that confusion. You don't have to worry about which drones are in... Like, if these two units get near each other, which is the drones and which is the drone unit? So, tactical drones being gone, that's fine. Crisis suit commanders. Now, there are commanders who are in battle suits, but they used to have three options. There was the Enforcer battle suit, which was like the big crisis suit. The Cold Star battle suit, which was the big flying crisis suit. And then there was the Crisis Suit Commander, which was built with the normal Crisis Suit kit. That last one is no longer an option. Now, whether it's not an option because Crisis Suits are only available in groups of three now, and they didn't want you splitting up a box and having two Crisis Suits left over that you couldn't do, never mind that you could have made three commanders out of them, but if you had a Crisis Suit Commander and you liked using the Crisis Suit Commander, that's too bad. That is not a viable choice anymore. It's just gone. It hasn't been replaced with anything. It's gone. And the last one is Crisis Suits. Now there are Crisis Suits in this codex, but the idea of the Crisis Suit as a unit that you could build and trick out any way you wanted, that is no longer an option. The idea of single crisis, like a unit of crisis suits with any sort of loadout that you can take in units of three or six, does not exist anymore in this codex. Did you like customizing builds to fit your playstyle? That's too bad. That is not a thing that's in here anymore. Why not? Because that's not how we make the kits. I can't think of any other reason. Actually, there is one other reason, and we've talked about it before. It is impossible to balance crisis suits when you have no war gear costs. When everything is a unit just has a fixed cost, you cannot possibly balance it when there are so many options.
I think it is more of that latter one, Rob.
Yeah, it's just... It's frustrating. And I can't say... I'm not surprised, but I am disappointed that they didn't come up with other ways to try to fix it. And I will point out that they did actually address a couple of the issues, because one of the issues with crisis suits was that the big thing was the triple ion blaster crisis suit brick. Usually six units of cyclic ion blasters with triple cyclic ion blasters, because... that was the best gun. It was just mathematically, it was the best gun. You could overcharge it to do more damage and be stronger. There were enough models in the unit. You could afford to lose one if you failed your hazardous weapon checks. You could put them on attach a commander to make them even better, or just have them as a big brick of six. And so nobody was using any of the other weapons. So I get it. I get it. That I hated that build. I hated that was the way crisis suits were being run. Because one of the classic things with crisis suits is like you could double up on weapons if you wanted to, or you could have kind of an all-takers crisis suit that could handle different kinds of things, which of course does not play well into the greater good rules, because they don't want you splitting fire against targets, because they'll penalize you if you use the greater good rule. So there was no good way to... fix the crisis suit as it currently was. I am going to say the method that they chose is possibly one of the worst methods they could have possibly chosen. We'll get to that in a moment. So those are all the things that are gone. Now, one thing I think is interesting is I mentioned like Long Strike is gone. Like Anva is gone because he was also a fine cast model. Anshi is gone because he was also a fine cast model that they don't make anymore. Long Strike is gone. Fine cast model. There's been a lot of fine cast models getting removed lately. Vespid and Firesight Marksman, which like the sniper drones, those are still not plastic. Those are metal or fine cast. Those are still in the book. They didn't give us a new Vespid kit that we've seen. Maybe there will be one eventually, and they just didn't want to.
Maybe this holiday season at the end of the year, we'll get a kill team for him.
You know, it wouldn't be terrible. That'd be a good way to drop them in, would be a kill team. But yeah, so it's not a wholesale purge of fine cast, although most of the fine cast is gone, but there's a couple of models that are still in here that are fine cast. Now, as far as other things that we've noticed, like I mentioned that the commanders in Enforcer and Cold Star suits are still in, their rules, for the most part, have not changed. The Enforcer commander still worsens AP of incoming attacks by one when they're leading a unit. The Cold Star commander still gives all your units weapons assault and gives them a move characteristic of 12. I love Cold Star suits. I have no problem with the Cold Star suit, and honestly with the Enforcer suit. They're both fine. They both have their roles. There's actually two changes to all their war gear. As for the most part, they didn't change, but they did mark cyclic ion blasters as a weapon that could not be duplicated. Now, before, the only weapon that couldn't be duplicated was the air-bursting frag projector. Now, there's two of them. And the reason that is because there's only one of each in the commander box. And the commander box makes both of these suits. So, again, we are getting options limited because of what is in the kit. In this case, I think reducing the ion blaster to a one-off is not a bad move. And otherwise, these are just as customizable as they ever were. They are still good choices, except for what they're limited in leading. And they are limited in leading three units that are all crisis suits. Because crisis suits are still in the game, just not in the same way. But otherwise, they still function the same. These guys still function the same way. Shadow Sun and Farsight are completely unchanged. And Shadow Sun has always been Supreme Commander. If you have her, she has to be your warlord. She's actually a really good character. She is a stealth lone operative infiltrating character who has a bubble of reroll hit rolls of one. And you can get CP back with her whenever somebody within 6 inches is targeted with a strat. And incoming wounds automatically lower one from the wound roll. She's bristling with guns. She's a great choice. Farsight is a fantastic choice and one of the few melee-focused options in the book, with options for either strength 10, AP minus 2, 3 damage hits, or twice as many strength 6, AP minus 1, 1 damage hits in melee. He's got a 24-inch plasma rifle that hits on twos with two shots. Quick correction, Farsight was not completely unchanged. He actually went from a 3-up save to a 2-up save, and he traded his opportunity to fight and re-roll hit rolls and wound rolls for a free stratagem for 0 CP, even if it's one that's already been used before. So lost a little bit of consistency, but got some survivability and keys in with like some of the other like Space Marine captain style abilities. So he's pretty good. There were the other change to the regular suits, though. His plasma rifle is 24 inches. That's what plasma rifles were in the index. And in most of the history of the game, plasma rifles are now 18-inch range. They lost 6 inches of range also. So that hurts. They really want Tau to get closer and closer, that seems. Cadre Fireblades, Ethereals are your generic non-battle suit HQ kind of command leader options. Ethereals give you a chance to get more CP, which is still not as good as some armies where they have characters that just automatically give you CP. Ethereals still have to roll for it. Again, this was an opportunity to fix that, but they didn't. They chose not to, so eh. Cadre Fireblades allow you to add one to the number of attacks. Fireblades in units of Breachers, in Devilfish, is good in like 8th and 9th edition. It is still very good in 10th edition, especially in a Mount Ka detachment, so you'll still see plenty of those. Darkstrider is one of our few. It was one of the other named characters. He can only join Pathfinders. He's good for joining Pathfinders, but he's only an okay character otherwise. Lets you add one to the wound rolls, but generally what you're doing with Pathfinders is spotting for people. Strike teams and breacher teams are your Tau infantry choice. These are your two battle line. They are always battle line. You don't have to have a particular detachment to make them battle line. And I will say their rules changed a little bit. Strike teams used to let you fire Overwatch for on 4-ups. They do not have that anymore. Instead, they have suppression fire so that whenever they hit an enemy infantry unit with their guns, anytime that enemy unit makes an attack until the start of your next turn, they're -1 to hit, regardless of whether it's ranged or melee. So strike teams at providing some suppressive fire is actually kind of an interesting way to use them. Breachers are still the same. If you're targeting a unit that's on range of an objective marker, they reroll wound rolls. They're fantastic. Everybody should be running breachers in Tau, and they generally do. And now let's talk crisis suits. Stat line has not changed. Like 10-inch movement, 5 toughness, 3 plus movement, 4 wounds, 7-up leadership, 2 OC. You can no longer take them in units of 6. They are fixed in units of 3. There are 3 variations, so you could still have a bunch of crisis suits on the table. They are considered vehicles. They have walker. They fly. They have the battle suit trait. They are not customizable. Well, a little bit, but not really. So the 3 categories are Sunforge suits, which have dual fusion blasters, which are meltaguns, and have a 4-up invulnerable save. Meltaguns still suck in this edition because their strength isn't high enough and they don't have any anti-vehicle or anti-monster ability. They are strength 9 with melta 2. 1 shot each, so a unit of these will have 6 shots. They're hitting on 4s. The one benefit is they have a rule that's set called Sunforge, which says anytime they allocate attacks to a monster or vehicle, you can reroll wound and damage. That does help the fusion blaster not feel so bad because you're rerolling 5s against most vehicles or monsters to wound. And rerolling the damage is nice because they are D6, so if you roll 1s, you've got a chance to save it. They're not terrible what they do. They do have an invulnerable save, which means they're more likely to survive getting up close. But you cannot customize them in any other way. You can take drones, but you cannot take duplicates of drones. So you can take a gun drone, any number of models in here. So you could have up to 3 gun drones or 3 marker drones or 3 shield drones. But you can mix and match, but nobody can take like 2 gun drones. So you can't have a whole bunch of extra shots. They're fine. They are also one of the few units in the book that can deep strike. Next one is the Crisis Fire Knife battle suits. Now, this one, the Fire Knife is a classic build going back to like 3rd and 4th edition Tau. And the Fire Knife was equipped with a plasma rifle and a missile pod. And that is how these are equipped. Now, you do have the option of going either dual missile pod or dual plasma or one of each. You have a little bit of customization, but that's about it. They have no invulnerable save. They cannot take one. They did lose 6 inches of range off the plasma rifle. So instead of having 30 inches on the missile and 24 on the plasma, it's 30 and 18. Anytime they make a range attack, they reroll hit rolls 1. Not terrible. If they target a unit that's at starting strength, they can reroll the hits entirely. So they're good for going after somebody who has taken no wounds or no damage. And they can ignore any or all modifiers to the hit roll. Now, again, that's modifiers to the hit roll. Greater good adjusts ballistic skill, so this does not allow them to ignore the penalty to splitting fire. I mean, it's fine. They've got 3 default. They've got 3 shots each. They can go down to 2 at closer range with slightly higher strength and damage, or up to 4 with longer range but slightly worse, but with the worst profile. But that's it. The two guns, like none of the suits have more than two guns. And then there's the Starth Scythe battle suits, which are made to kill hordes. They come with a burst cannon and a flamer. Again, these are ranges of 18 and 12. They can choose to go dual flamer or dual burst cannon or one of each. And they have like all these have the same limitation on drones. Any number of models can take up to two drones, no duplicates on a particular model. Their rule, Starth Scythe, is every time they make a ranged attack that doesn't target a monster or a vehicle, they improve the AP by one, and they can shoot when a turn when they fall back. Why this all annoys me is because I hope you magnetized your suits, because there's going to be a lot of players who have built three weapon suits, because you always could, because that was how the game was made. And a lot of times it was three weapons plus maybe a war gear option, because like three weapons plus a shield generator, three weapons plus an early warning override, three weapons plus an iridium suit, which a lot of those are no longer options. They're just there for, you know, cosmetic purposes, but you could do three weapons and an upgrade, or you could do at least two weapons and an upgrade, or at least three weapons. There's going to be a ton of Tau players who are suddenly looking at all their crisis suits, and if they did not magnetize, all of those suits are now illegal. If you mixed a fusion blaster with anything and didn't do two fusion blasters, too bad, that suit cannot be used. If you did a burst cannon and a plasma rifle, nope, that's not an option. You can't do that. You cannot take that. Like, even discounting the fact that, like, there are no cyclic ion blasters at all, that's not an option for any of these suits, which is going to annoy some people, I'm sure, because there's a ton of people who are doing triple ion blaster suits. There's a bunch of people who have either tried to track down the bits on eBay or have 3D printed ion blasters, and they probably glued them to their suits. And my suits are not magnetized. I don't like magnetizing Tau weapons because they always end up being wobbly on the model, and I hate that. I have a few old fire knives that are missile pod and plasma rifle. I actually have a couple of units that I can salvage without having to do any modifications. I have a lot of models that I'm going to have to break weapons off of, and that annoys me so much. There will be people who will rage quit over this. Like, this is the worst way they could have done that. And I'm just really disappointed in this particular choice, this way to address this issue, because they answered it. They solved it. But my God, at what cost, and what a way to do it.
Yeah, I'm thinking of how many big mechs I can't use anymore.
Mm-hmm.
That, I mean, it's the same thing.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure listeners are very familiar with me and Kevin complaining about what they did to Chaos Terminators. And I have an entire set of dual Lightning Claw Terminators that I had to retire because I can only use one in a unit. But this is like entire units just wiped out effectively. Like, yeah, you just can't use that at all anymore. I don't know if they're going to let, you know, we haven't seen any of the Legends stuff. Like, will we see Anshi and Anva in the Legends files? Hopefully. But I don't know if like old crisis suits will end up in Legends, because I mean, maybe that'll push people to play narrative because it's the only way you can use those suits anymore. But editor's note, the day after we recorded this, Games Workshop came out in an article on Warhammer Community and did confirm that the current existing crisis suit configuration, where you can take multiple weapons and mix and match however you want, will be made available in Legends. So in narrative play, those suits will still be legal. And also, like, the fact that you're limited to three, so, like, a lot of these suits don't have, they don't put out a ton of firepower. Like, the Sunforge isn't terrible, like, for getting, like, for taking out vehicles. The fact that they can reroll the wound roll is about the one saving grace for them. Fire knives aren't bad. I just don't think they have enough shots. Plasma rifles also used to be rapid fire. They are not anymore. And they haven't been in this edition. I think that was a mistake. They probably should have made plasma rifles rapid fire, because Space Marine plasma rifles were rapid fire. Why can't Tau plasma rifles be rapid fire? Other than they don't have a gets hot option. But I mean, you already took away 6 inches of range. Give something in exchange. Two shots at 18 rather than one shot at 24. But anyway, I'm going to move on. I'm ranting enough at this point. From this point, the codex actually doesn't bother me too much. Most things didn't change. There's a bunch of new crude options. Stealth suits actually got slightly better, actually noticeably better, because when it used to be when stealth suits guided for someone, they observed for someone, the guided unit could reroll wound rolls of one, and that's very good. Now they can reroll hit and wound rolls of one. So stealth suits are way better for theoretically the same price. I don't know if they'll replace people using a bunch of Tetras, which is a Forge World only option, which is not in this book, and one which I would like to see moved into Legends, because it's ridiculous that there are more Tetras being used than GW has ever actually produced, because there's a ton of them being 3D printed, and I hate having to depend on a Forge World unit to make an army somewhat competitive. Ghost Keels are still fantastic. Infiltrator, Lone Operative, Stealth, big guns, but set up in such a way that you don't want to split fire. They are great at harassing people and being distraction carnifexes, but also with Lone Operative and Stealth, they're very difficult for people to deal with. So they're fantastic. And the fact that they've got a couple of strats that work very well for them is still good. Pathfinders are still pretty much the same. Their big thing is they can observe twice for people, which gives you more observer choices. That's great. They can also take some very decent weapons with like rail rifles and ion rifles, so they're really nice. Farsight teams are snipers with infiltrators and lone operative. Precision rifle, like three precision shots with... if they are being guided, they get to reroll their hit rolls. They're fine. They're nice to plop onto like a back row objective or something and sit on and just plink away at characters, or put into a high space and try to take out characters. They're fine. Vespid. It's the only other deep strike option in the book. Their big thing is they can deep strike every turn because they can go into strategic reserves at the end of your movement phase. So, and they have passable guns, two shots, BS4, strength 5, AP minus 2, 2 damage, 18 inch range with assault. They're good at killing Marines. They always have been. Downside is because they are an alien, they do not have greater good. So you can't spot with them or for them.
They just need to upgrade their special translation hats.
Yeah, they need the special translation helm to give them greater good. That would be really good. Of course, that would actually cost points, and we don't do that here anymore.
We don't do that anymore.
Yeah. Then we get into the new Kroot units. There are eight. Actually, well, there's nine if you include the Kroot Farstalkers, which is the kill team that they released back in last year's Gallodark season. Which is fine. It's a perfectly good unit. Does some neat things. You've got the three Shapers, the Trail Shaper, the War Shaper, the Flesh Shaper. They all have the same stat line. 7-inch movement, 3 toughness, 6 up save, 3 wounds, 7 up leadership, 1 OC. You're going to be running these in a Kroot detachment, so they're going to have a 6 up, 5 up, and vulnerable. Because don't run Kroot if you don't do the Kroot hunting pack. Just don't. They're way better with the hunting pack. The Trail Shaper's thing is he's got 7. I think also they all have infiltrators, stealth, and scout 7 inches. And they can all join carnivores and farstalkers. The Trail Shaper, when an enemy unit ends a normal advance or fallback move within 9 inches, this unit can move, do a normal move of d6 inches. So they can either get closer or farther away, your choice. And then after both players have deployed their armies, you can redeploy this unit and one other friendly Kroot unit, and you can put them into strategic reserve. So it gives you a chance to be kind of like put something out there a little bit far forward. And then if your opponent puts them in a position where you don't want them, you just pull them off the board and put them into reserves. Not bad. The War Shaper. And I said the War Shaper should always take that upgrade that gives their attacks precision and devastating wounds. And that's because their default weapon, which is the dart bow and tri-blade, which is just really cool, the idea of somebody bringing a bow and arrow to a gunfight. Assault, heavy, anti-infantry 3+. He critically hits infantry, critically wounds infantry on threes, and his attacks do 2 damage each. So having precision and devastating wounds is terrifying. He is a character killer. And he has D3+1 shooting attacks each turn. He's fantastic. Like, the other option you can give him is the Blade Stave and Prey Hook, which gives him 4 attacks with lethal hits that do 2 damage. I would take him with the Dark Blow and Tri-Blade every time. Once per battle round, a unit from your army with this ability can be targeted for a strat with a strat for 0 CP. Again, it'll have to be a battle tactic. Once per battle, pick a crew unit within 12 inches that is battle shocked. It is no longer battle shocked. That's really, really good too. Finally, the Flesh Shaper, which is kind of the old school Shaper that they used to have. His guns and weapons aren't that amazing, but when he's leading a unit, their melee weapons have sustained hits 1. And when they're, when they lead a unit, the unit has Feel No Pain 6 up. If they destroy one or more enemy units in the fight phase, then their Feel No Pain goes to a 5 up. So really good to put into a unit that you're going to have fighting close up. The Kroot Lone Spear, which is one I'm really excited to see. Lone Operative, which we figured it would. So no Infiltrator, but Lone Operative. Scout 7-inch and Stealth. 12-inch movement, 5 Toughness, 6 Wounds. A 5-up armor save, because he's actually, like, the thing he's riding has better armor. One of the weapons is that he can take is a Blast Javelin. Assault Blast, 18-inch range, so a little close. D6 attacks at strength 12, AP minus 2, 2 damage. Really nice. And then with Blast, that's also, gonna do more attacks to larger units. There's the Hunting Javelin, which is his melee weapon, which has Lance. Weapon skill 3, 3 attacks, strength 4, AP minus 1, 1 damage. The thing he's riding always gives you 4 extra attacks at hitting on 4s at strength 5. His other options can be a long gun, which has heavy and precision, so you can make him into a sniper, or just a close combat weapon. His thing is, every time he makes a ranged attack, each time another Kroot model from your army attacks that same unit, they reroll hits. So he basically marks targets to be hit. And then he has Fire and Fade built in. Every time he does a shooting attack, if he's not in engagement range, he just moves away 6 inches. But he just can't charge. Those are fantastic, and having some strength 10 weaponry in a Kroot army is great. They absolutely need that. Kroot Carnivores, they are not too, they're kind of squishy, but a couple of big changes for them. First off, they've got a couple of other weapon options. They have a sergeant called a Long Quill who can take a carbine, which is just a 2 damage version of their gun, which is fine. A little less range, but more damage. One guy can take a Tangle Bomb Launcher, which is a strength 5 blast weapon with D3 shots. But their other big changes are they went from OC1 to OC2, so they can actually really take objectives now, and it's good because they can become battle line in the right army. And they have sticky objectives, which is really good for them. They are a fast-moving unit. They have stealth. They have scouts 7-up, so they're harder to hit. They'll have invuln saves in the Kroot Hunting Pack, and they have sticky objectives. In a Kroot Hunting Pack, they are great. Krutox Riders are your gun platform Kroot. They have a blast weapon that they can take, which is strength 6, but I would recommend the Repeater Cannon, which is a 2 attack, strength 7, AP minus 1, 2 damage. It's basically an autocannon, but it with 36 inches of range and rapid fire 2, which they did not have before. They had this weapon as the Kroot gun, which had less AP. It's AP minus 1 now, but they also gained rapid fire on it. So they're way better there. They have a bunch of attacks thanks to the Krutox fists as extra attacks. And once per turn in your opponent's shooting phase, if a friendly Krut infantry unit within 6 inches was shot at, then after the enemy unit has finished shooting, this unit gets to shoot. So you can then fire that repeater cannon at the guy that shot the other nearby Krut unit, or your own, because you are a friendly Krut unit to yourself. And Krutox Riders can come in units of three, so they can actually put out a ridiculous amount of firepower, of strong firepower. Krutox Rampagers, which are the melee version of Krutox, not like they come with hunting blades, which are lance weapons. So, you know, you want to charge in. They've got scout 7 inches, you know, scout 7. Every time they end a charge move, you roll a D6 for each model in this unit that's within engagement range of the enemy unit. For each 4+, the enemy unit suffers D3 mortal wounds. If one or more models are destroyed by the mortal wounds, they have to take a battle shock test. So really, they're just there to, I mean, line breakers. That's what they're there to do. So these guys coming at you with a 5+ invulnerable, 5+ armor, 5+ invulnerable to shooting attacks, 6+ invulnerable in melee, and with 5 wounds each at tough 6, that's pretty nasty. They come in, they start in groups of 3, they can be in groups of 6. They're 7 attacks each, because 3 for the hunting blades and 4 for their rampager fists, which are also sustained hits 1. I really like I'm liking everything I'm seeing from the Krut army. I really dig it. And then Krut hounds used to give you have benefits to adding 1 to the wound roll. Now, if they're within 6 inches of a Krut and infantry unit, they can advance and charge at the start, and it's at the start of the command phase. So, if they're near an infantry unit at the start of the turn, then on your turn they can move, advance, and charge. And also, if they're within 12 inches of one or more Krut character models, they go from OC0 to OC1, so they can also help you take objectives. They're not real tough. They're T3, 1 wound. 6+ save, but they are a good take control of an objective, or just harassment target, or just moving up ahead and getting into a table quarter to do until they fix the thing where things that are OC0 can't hold objectives or can't perform actions. They're going to be a pretty solid add-on to any Krut army. In fact, if you max out on Krut stuff, there's enough units in here you can't take everything. In you're gonna have to make some cuts, and I haven't even gotten to the Krut Farstalkers, which are the options from Kill Team. They haven't really changed. They just, you select a unit from the opponent's army at the start of the battle, and every time the Farstalkers try to fight it, they have lethal hits and precision. So again, they are bounty hunters, so they're going after their character killers. But you've got plenty of other options for that already. Otherwise, everything else is pretty much the same. Piranhas, broadsides, piranhas are your harasser units with burst or melta guns. Broadsides carry, kind of man-portable rail guns that are still pretty nasty. And they're tough. They have a 4+ feel no pain against mortal wounds, which unfortunately doesn't work against devastating wounds, but I'm wondering if this was printed before the devastating wounds change was made. Riptides are still a viable alternative to crisis suits, because they have a similar wound count, better toughness, better saves. They actually have an invulnerable save, better guns. I think you're still going to see a lot of triple Riptide, especially if the points are based off of what's in the latest Munitorum and not in the Codex, because the Codex points are way off. Hammerheads are still your the strongest weapon in the Codex, with a strength 20 devastating wounds railgun that does D6 plus 6 damage. It is ridiculous. Sky Rays are an interesting unit, because they were originally developed to be an anti-flyer unit, and they still are. You can reroll hits against anything that has the fly keyword. But their missile racks, like a lot of units in the army can take what are called seeker missiles, which are these one-shot missiles that are like strength 14, AP minus 3. One of the best anti-vehicle weapons we have, and you can load them on like all, like broadsides can take one, devilfish, like your transports can take two, piranhas can take two. Skyrays just have a whole rack of them that can just are not one shot. They were already a good choice. They've got a ridiculous amount of range, good damage, three attacks each. They gave them twin linked as well, so they can reroll wounds. So Skyrays are a fantastic choice. Point wise, they are in the current Munitorum. Let's see. Skyrays are 130 points compared to, I think, 100, same price as a Hammerhead. They're both good options. The one thing I like about the Skyrays over the Hammerheads is the Hammerhead has one shot at a time with that railgun, whereas these guys have three and have twin linked. The Hammerhead railgun is heavy, so if the Hammerhead sits still, you're hitting on threes. They can reroll, or they add one to hit rolls against monsters or vehicles, so that's really what they're made to kill. It's a phenomenal weapon. And they can also reroll a hit roll and reroll a wound roll, so like if you hit with a Hammerhead, you're gonna wound. But I think both of them have a roll, take whichever one you want. Also, the Skyray has the marker light keyword, which lets, you know, helps out for like observing for people. Devilfish still lets you disembark after it advances, so it lets you do like a full, like a rapid redeploy or like a rapid movement, drop off units. That's what people use for breachers. Very, very solid choice. The flyers are flyers. There's really not much point to discussing the aircraft. They're not good. And then there's the Storm Surge, which I mentioned before. It's not even a battle suit, so it can't benefit from the battle suit detachment. And it has so many guns, but they're not all made for the same target, so it really can't use greater good very well. The rules worked better with it, but that's what it is. And then finally, we have the three Tidewall fortifications, which I have never seen anyone actually use. So the big thing is they are fortifications that can move around. One of them has a railgun on it, but it only hits on fives and doesn't have... It is a twin-linked railgun, so it's very likely to wound, but it still only hits on fives. Also, none of these can transport Kroot units. They can only or battle suits, so you can only put Fire Warriors on them. So, Strikers and Breachers, and you want your Breachers in transports, which I guess these are technically transports, but eh. I'm not even going to get into the points, really, because, like I said, they're going to be wildly inaccurate, although I do find it interesting that the crisis suits, which are currently 200 points for a unit of three, have been the most expensive one is the Fire Knife at 165. Starth Scythes are 140. So you're like your anti-horde ones are 140. And Sunforge, which are your anti-vehicle and anti-monster suits, are 160. But again, these are all capped at units of three, which I guess is the trade-off for the fact that you could have nine units of crisis suits on the table. I'm torn because there's some things in this book I really like. I love what they're doing with the Kroot in this one. I think the Kroot are getting the best treatment officially that they've ever had. I like the implementation of Moltke. I think the Moltke detachment is probably the strongest one for just standard play. There's some interesting things in the Retaliation cadre, but crisis suits, which a lot of it is built around, because like the only units that can take the upgrades are the commanders that are meant to be leading crisis suit squads, because leaders don't get any benefit if they're not leading squads, are now leading substandard squads. For everything I like, there's something I just absolutely don't. But what differentiates this from like the Dark Angels Codex for me is you lost a few units with the Dark Angels, but that was primarily due to the Space Marine purging of like old bikes and things like that. But you could still take, like, you still had Deathwing Knights, and you lost, like, an Apothecary. You lost a couple of options, but for the most part, you still had a lot of the units you had. And your Deathwing Terminators, well, I shouldn't say they weren't completely made, they weren't made illegal, because if you had Storm Shields on them, you couldn't run them as Deathwing Terminators anymore. But, man, I just cannot believe the change they made to Crisis. I think, like, there are people who will be frustrated that they can't take, you know, Storm Shields in a Deathwing unit. There are people I honestly think will quit the game or quit playing Tau because of this. Like, this is the worst possible way they could have addressed this issue. And I think it is because they painted themselves into a corner. This army didn't really gain a lot of power. If anything, it stayed pretty much the same. It definitely got more options with the Groot stuff. And technically, it got more options because there's three varieties of Crisis Suits. But they definitely, I think the changes to Crisis Suits definitely downcycles the power a bit on them. And I'm wondering if that's what we're seeing is an intentional kind of depowering. Because I think we saw that a little bit with the Dark Angels. And I do think we're seeing it with the Tau, where the emphasis, and this has been made clear, they've stated this several times, and I think we're really seeing the effects of this. The game is being depowered, so it is more about table and like area control and objectives than it is about killing. I know they said that, like, hey, 10th edition was going to be like, units are going to survive. It's going to be the most survivable edition yet. It wasn't at launch, but I see where they're getting there.
Now, it does seem like they are trying to, and maybe this is something we're going to see, the de-escalation of units and codexes going forward, and that might be a good thing. I know I'll put a comparison to, like, MMOs in here. MMOs, every expansion, you have to, like, keep on increasing the power level so the players, like, feel like they're getting stronger. But every once in a while, you have to do, like, a numbers crunch mm-hmm. and make everyone weaker just so you can eventually escalate that power again. And 40K might have been at the point, and this is their addition to kind of tone things down and reset the game to where maybe in 11th, I hate saying 11th already, they'll escalate it again, but maybe just, you know, it's minorly. Hopefully not for at least two more years, knock on wood. I don't know. I don't like the cycle, because I feel like whoever has the last Codex World Leaders never gets to really play it, feels like.
I think also it's just, it feels awkward because it doesn't feel like the depowering has necessarily been applied equally well across all factions. Obviously, we saw that at the beginning of 10th very badly with Eldar. It is much better now, although, again, it seems like, at least at a competitive level. Now, narrative play, casual play, that's going to be its own thing entirely. And I still think that Games Workshop is trying very hard to thread that needle of making narrative play interesting while still trying to support competitive play. But it does feel like the depowering is kind of a rolling process that we're seeing as codexes come out. The balance is generally better. But yeah, just the ways they've chosen to do it in here really, really surprised me. And also we're seeing more of the philosophy of, well, if it's not a bit in the kit that we have set up, if it's not like you can't build this unit exactly this way with the kit we shipped out, you're not allowed to build the unit that way. We saw it with Terminators. We saw it with Deathwing Terminators, and now we're seeing it with Crisis Suits and the Commanders. Although I think the Commander boxes actually do have, they don't have as many weapons to, like, because you can still make a quad weapon Commander. And I know the Commander box doesn't come with like four fusion blasters or plasma rifles or burst cannons. So I do think it's interesting that they'll still let you kit bash that a little bit, but they will not let you do it with regular Crisis Suits. But again, doing that with the way they've done points is nigh impossible to balance. So this, I think we just saw, this is the confluence of you can only build what's in the kit, and we can't balance things any other way, so this is what we'll have to do. And the fact that you can't even like mix and match inside a crisis suit unit, besides the, well, you can double up on this weapon or that one or have one of each. And I think that is on a model by model basis. So.
Yeah. Tyranid Warriors have a similar thing where
mm-hmm.
they made, now I have melee ones and I have ranged ones.
Yeah. Yeah.
Don't get those mixed up.
Yeah.
It ends up being a case where, like, from a casual and narrative sense and versus the competitive balance nature, like, you can't, you try and please everyone and you end up pleasing nobody.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of, I feel like that's what's kind of happening here.
Yeah, I agree. I think, yeah, like and also based on when this book, like, I'm curious when this was written. Obviously, there's a long lead cycle on anything like this, and my guess is, judging from the point values they use in this book, I think things were being finalized right around the launch of the edition. And it does, so it makes me think the index crisis suit loadout was set up because that's what people had and they wanted to have that continuity of play where somebody could just pick up and start playing 10th edition with the stuff they had 9th edition, although it doesn't explain the Tyranid Warrior issue, which still weird, but you know, that was, I think that at the time, that was like one of the only units where they're like, well, we split it into two different things because we can't balance it. We saw that with Mechanicus where they split like there's the guys with the guns and there's the guys with the javelins. And that's like, and we're going to have two separate groups of those. And now we're seeing it with crisis suits where it's like, well, we have no way to do it. So we'll make one unit that does this and one unit that does that and one unit that does this. And none of them have any of the weapons that are actually problematic. So we've solved the problem. But it makes me think this, I don't think this is necessarily a reaction unless they did a last minute fix. Like, that seems like a weird choice to be a last minute fix to, well, we can't figure out any other way to solve this problem that we've created. Or, yeah, we know this is a problem in the index, but we got to get the index out in time. We can't fix the index later because we've printed those cards, so we'll have to fix it in the codex, but at what cost? So,
yeah, they printed those cards, but how many did they print? Not enough.
Yeah, not nearly enough. So, and I said I would mention Kevin's, because Kevin got a chance to look at the codex as well, and his response was just gifs of anguished screaming. I don't think he's happy with the results either.
That's okay. He's just going to convert more of his Tau figures into Chaos, yeah. And he'll be happy.
Yeah. I was saying in chat that's like, well, there's not really a good use for crisis suits anymore. He says, no, they make perfectly good proxies for 8-bound. Like, he's not wrong. So, this, I think I have to say, this kind of falls under the... at this point, I'm not even mad. I'm just disappointed. Well, but I think there are people who would be mad.
Right. And I think this is just going off the tales of the Dark Angels one, where, I mean, you got the range from the sky is falling to... yeah, things have been toned down, nerfed, but it's still playable. And I think Tau players are probably going to fall into that exact same range of emotions.
Yeah. I do think there's a lot of playable builds in this. I think the Kroot Hunting Pack will be very interesting and fun to play. I think Mont Kaz is going to be very strong and doesn't need to lean into crisis suits terribly hard. And there's plenty of other options. I think people who like the Kalyan style of play that like leans into like stealth suits and stuff like that, I like that. I think that one is still viable. I do think they all have some interesting like board control, objective control options. I think the one that is the big loser, unfortunately, is the Retaliation Cadre, and that's just because it is specifically built around using crisis suits, because all the upgrades are for commanders who will want to be leading crisis suits because that's the only thing they can lead. Crisis suits will still eat up a good chunk of their points. And like the strats aren't bad. Like if you didn't look at the data sheets, that would be fine. And there's other things like Riptides are battle suits, Ghost Keels are battle suits, Stealth suits are battle suits. So they can still benefit from a lot of these. And they do have the fly keyword, but they also can't do the only ones that can deep strike are crisis suits. So they're the only ones that get the benefit of the three up deep strike or 3-inch deep strike ability. They're the only ones who can get benefit of the Starfire ignition system to let them go back into reserve so they can deep strike again. Like it's built to use crisis suits, but it's just, they're not, I don't know. I don't want to say crisis suits are necessarily bad, but I think they're a substandard choice now. I think there are better choices in the army.
So Rob, could you just like stuff a Vespid into like a stealth suit to make it deep strike?
No, unfortunately not. And you can't have them carry the stealth suits and like drop them down. That would be also kind
of
interesting.
That'd be cool. A Tau drop pod.
Yeah. But yeah, like the book is still playable. There's still some interesting things to do in here. It's just the way they fix it. Like, I'm just going to keep coming back to that. So yeah, crisis suits are just, they did crisis suits dirty in this book, but maybe there was no other way to do them based on how everything else is built.
And I keep thinking of like other units. Like I don't have like specific examples, but like another range of just units that used to have a bunch of different weapon options, but now instead they just have a generic, like this is a shooting gun. Like at least they didn't do that.
That's true. They didn't do the combi weapon treatment on us, where you went from having a bunch of combi weapon options to there is combi weapon. Okay. It does combi weapon thing.
Right.
So, yeah, like, I mean, right.
That could have been another approach that they took, but with the way Tau is and the importance of their guns, like, I'm kind of glad that they didn't do that, but I mean, that almost would have been a simpler solution and would have made the suits that you have not be illegal.
Yeah, yeah. Doing like a battle suit guns option would be one way they could go. Like, even if it was like battle suit guns and you have like one of three shooting profiles, kind of like they do for like obliterators. Well, that would have been... I think that might have actually been a better solution, where it's like it doesn't matter what guns you put on here. I think the only reason they didn't do that is because they wanted to keep the commanders to be very customizable.
Right.
But then you're going to have a case, well, on the commander, see all these guns, they do this. But on this unit that looks very much like the commander, they don't do that at all. And so maybe that's why they chose not to go that route. Honestly, I think doing that on the commander wouldn't have been a bad idea either. It would have annoyed people, but then it would be like, yeah, model them however you want, have fun with it. Like I think I might have actually, I hadn't thought of that, but now that you mentioned it, I think I almost would have preferred that option. Like it would have been a good way to say like, yeah, it doesn't matter what guns you put on there, just have fun with it.
Yeah, well, because like I know a bunch of Gene Stealer cult like used to have a bunch of different, like, weird melee weapons that all had, like, different rules, and then they, like, just consolidated them into, like, one thing. So it didn't matter what was on the model. And, like, I kind of like that approach, in general, just because it means it streamlines things and makes things easier to build units, but, you know.
Right. Yeah. Build units one and also ease speed of play if you're not having to remember, okay, this guy has this guy. Oh, did that guy die or how many of those are left in the squad? So, I mean, I like it when a unit has one weapon profile, maybe a separate one for the sergeant. And simple to keep on the table. It's pretty fast to play.
Also, I think but the other big disappointment is that we only got four detachments, and we knew one of them was going to be reserved for Kroot. I would have liked to have seen five detachments and a Kroot one, or maybe four detachments and a Kroot one. And I think this is also a case of, well, we painted ourselves into a corner because we made the detachment rule Kalyan, and the only other option we have is Montka. So, well, now what do we do? Well, we need to have a Kroot one, and I guess we have a battle suit one for doing the eight, which you can't even really do anymore because you can't have crisis suit commanders, but...
I mean, they could have also narratively say, hey, here's another strategy that one of our Earth cast came up with that uses vehicles and maybe had a vehicle one. Maybe have something for flyers in the vehicle one that make flyers do something. Oh,
stealth suit ones where like,
oh my gosh,
the stealth suits like help like other units be more stealthy.
I mean, I was kind of expecting, in addition to like the Montka and the Kalyan, of a Farsight one and a Shadow Sun one, and then the Kroot one. Ah, that would have been cool.
Yeah, like a Farsight Enclave specific one. And I'm, you know, there's the argument, so, well, the Montka or the Retaliation Cadre would be the Farsight one, but it's like that. I think you can do better. So
I feel like the way they have this game designed. Like, it could be easy enough to just add in detachments later, but that really lessens the importance of buying the book, which is something that they really want us to do.
Yeah.
And I mean, there's still... You feel bad for not getting all your rules.
There's still tons of cool stuff in the book, though, because it's got all the painting things. It's got the... I still like the heraldry, and I love it when they put that in the books. They've got the history, especially if you're not new, if you're new to Tau. I mean, and they move the story along ever so slightly.
Yeah. I feel like the thing that Games Workshop needs to understand is, like, make the rules to play the game available, and, like, the people who are going to buy the book are still going to buy the book, but if they're not going to buy the book, you can still sell them models if you give them rules.
Yeah.
No, that is 100% true, because I know, like I said earlier, in the narrative, Crusade, I mean, I'm playing against Tyranids. I don't have the Tyranid book. I can ask my opponent what each thing does, and he'll tell me, but if I'm, like, thinking about things on, like, a Thursday evening, I mean, I'm not going to, like, message him and call him and say, hey, I'm trying to prep my list. What do you guys actually do? Well, if I could just, like, look it up on the app, that would just be so much easier, because I might not want to buy Tyranids, but if I have to play against them, it would be nice if I could also know the rules of the game.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and I also, and we mentioned this before, the GW is kind of an outlier in this, because most games now have either moved towards the rules are so simple because there's only like so many armies that everything's either in one book, like your core book also has all your unit profiles, or like you get the unit profiles when you buy the box of that, like that model, and like all the rules are available as like a free download. And they do focus on either selling you bundles to get more stuff, like that include all the tools you need, or they just like, you can just download the rules, buy the models you want, and just play. And GW is kind of in a weird place where they're, as much as they've been moving stuff forward, they're still very much in an old school way of thinking. But
so
that
just
doesn't
like
look
the
to
narrative,
be changing anytime soon.
They're inching their new policies forward.
More or less. Yeah. Yeah. They're maybe, hey, maybe when that 11th edition comes out, they'll get the rule distribution right. But
I'll just hold my breath.
I mean, don't do that, Richard. But I mean, 11 is 1-1. So, I mean, that could be their, we're number one twice. I mean, if they got it, right? Right?
No, we're doing first edition twice. We're all going back to Rogue Trader rules.
Hey, I have the book now.
Yeah. So anyway, that was the Codex Tau Empire review. I'm still going to play Tau. Like I will rebase my older Fire Knife suits onto 50 millimeter bases. I'll try utilizing them. I actually have a set of what were called Death Rain, which were dual missile pods, which now also be considered Fire Knife, so I can reuse them. I've got a couple of suits that I could turn into Sunforge and try it. Like I have some suits I can rehabilitate without too much trouble. Am I happy about having to do that? No, but it's playable. It's only fair that I really give it a try and see how they work. Maybe they're great. Maybe this was the right solution. It just doesn't feel like it. But overall, I think for every good thing in the book, there's a thing I don't like about the book. So it's kind of a wash. It's not terrible. I don't think it changes where Tau is, because most of the stuff in here will play about the same. I am curious to see how Kroot will play on the tabletop, but I think it looks neat. Overall, I think the army set, great presentation, neat models. Codex could use some work, but it is what we've got, so we'll have to make the best of it. So I think that's pretty much it. So we will be back in a couple of weeks. We are going to be talking about narrative play, about Crusade and our feelings about Crusade and other narrative systems and how they all stack up. And we should have Kevin back for that one, I believe. But until then, from all of us here at Preferred Enemies, I'm your host, Rob.
Dennis.
And Richard.
Good night, good gaming, and remember, it's all for the greater good.
The greater good.
Preferred Enemies is an Undergopher Radio production and is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-Alike 3.0 Unported License. Our theme music is Metal Slug 2 Super Vehicle 001/2 No Need to Reload, originally by Takushi Hayamuda and remixed by Roataka, courtesy of OC Remix. It can be found at ocremix.com.